My name is Tony Reid. Welcome to GAY, a radio programme for LGBTI people and their friends on Coast Access Radio 104.7 FM and other access radio stations around New Zealand. Today I am doing a book review, or I should say I'm starting a book review because it's likely to run over into a second programme. And it's an autobiography again. Boy from the Valleys, My Unexpected Journey by Luke Evans. Now, I saw that this was coming out and I thought Luke Evans was pretty well known as an actor and also pretty well known to be gay because he's been out for a very long time. But then when I went to get the book in Unity Books, they hadn't ordered it at all. Nobody had thought much about it. They discovered that it was easily available from Penguin Australia as well. So either bookshops have come to their senses since then and you can get it, or I've got the only copy in New Zealand. But if you go to Australia, you can probably buy it there. So Luke Evans was born on the 15th of April 1979, and he lived in a little village in South Wales called Aberbargoed. And I hope that's how I pronounce it. It's mentioned quite a bit in the book and in the substantial number of interviews he's also done as a result of the book. There's quite a lot on his childhood here. He was an only child, very close to his parents and grandparents. But not only that, but they were also Jehovah's Witnesses. So he said at school he was bullied as much for being a Jehovah's Witness as being gay. I was bullied for being gay before I even understood what it meant. For a long time, I assumed bender was just another random insult like wanker, another word often thrown my way that I didn't understand, until it dawned on me that the floppy wrist gesture that often accompanied these taunts was aimed at something very specific in me. Perhaps it was because I was a little more sensitive and delicate, more passive in dealing with aggression, or maybe it was just because I was more into art than rugby, who knows. The names kept coming, Jovie. Their shorthand for Jehovah's Witnesses. Shirtlifter, Bible basher, bender, gay boy. I think the worst one was Jovie Bender, because it combined two aspects of my identity that could never be reconciled. It wasn't possible to be a Jovie and a bender, because being gay was strictly forbidden by the religion, and so began a tormented tug of war in my head that would go on throughout all my years at school. It's a terribly dark place to be as a child, knowing you're somehow wrong, but with no idea why that is and how you can fix it. I hated school. He was a fairly dutiful Jehovah's Witness as well with his parents. He was sort of knocked on doors. He even got baptised as a sort of vain hope that the baptism might in some sense cure him from being gay. But fairly early on, he got very much the idea this was only temporary. This was to do with his current situation. If the teachers noticed what was going on, they never addressed it. Nobody ever asked me if I was okay. As a young person, you would usually have someone older who you could ask for advice, but I didn't have anyone to talk to. If my mother had realised how prolific the bullying was, I know she would have stepped in, but I couldn't tell my parents because their first question would be to ask what I was being bullied about, and I was too ashamed of the names I was being called to tell them. After all, the Bible states that homosexuals will die at Armageddon along with the murderers, thieves and adulterers. So I stayed quiet, kept my head down, stuck with the other witness kids and threw myself into my studies. And you wouldn't have had a clue from reading the glowing comments in my school reports from this time that I was anything other than blissfully happy in school. In a way, I was one of the lucky ones. The bullying didn't destroy my drive or ruin my future. Maybe it's because I had a lot of love at home. But even in junior school, I knew it wasn't me that was the problem. It was the bullies. As an only child, I was around adults a lot more than kids of my own age. So perhaps I grew up faster and developed a more mature perspective, an old head on young shoulders. But throughout my childhood, whenever bad stuff happened, there was a refrain going through my head. This is only temporary. Even at a young age, I had this clear-eyed view. Once school was over, I knew my life would begin. His was also a house full of music, by which I mean his father had lots of records and there was a record player. And Luke had his own record player at 12. He saved up to buy albums. First album he bought was Kylie Minogue. He said that was a bit of a giveaway, really, wasn't it? He then discovered Roberta Flack in a £1 bargain bin, actually, in a shop. And he really liked that album, especially the song The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, which in a way became his own signature tune. The first song on the album was The First Time I Ever Saw Your Face. It had a profound effect on me from the very first listen. I would listen to that song whenever I was feeling lost and alone, and it was like a release to me. It taught me about the power of music, and to this day, if you ask anyone who knows me, they'll tell you it's my favourite song, and I even recorded it for my first album. And we'll hear it later. He then discovered musicals, and he joined the school drama department. And the highlight of that was when he played Captain Von Trapp in The Sound of Music, and had everybody enchanted by his rendering of Edelweiss. And I'm afraid I checked on YouTube, and there's nothing of him singing Edelweiss, although there's lots of other stuff. He doesn't know anybody else who is gay, so he has no role models at all. He knows he'll have to leave home to be himself, and he plans to do so at 16. Even though the religion still exerted a magnetic pull over me at this stage, I was already preparing myself for the fact that as soon as I was legally allowed to leave home at 16, then I would probably have to. At that young age, it was terrifying to consider a life without my parents or friends or support of any kind at all. I was so close to my parents that the thought of losing them broke my heart, but that never felt like a reason not to leave. I reasoned that had they been able to make choices about that life, I reasoned that they had been able to make choices about their lives, so I needed to do the same. I still believed that being gay was a death sentence. I knew I would die at Armageddon with the rest of the sinners, but by this point I already felt it would be preferable to get a couple of years living as who I really was than spend a lifetime hiding away. I knew just how unhappy I would be if I stayed in Averbargoid for living a lie. I had no idea how I would do it and what it would really be like to lose everything and everyone I knew. But as soon as I could leave school, I planned to go somewhere I could introduce myself as the person I really was, make new friends and build a future outside the religion. Looking back, it's quite remarkable how much confidence I had in this plan, but by my early teens, I had already started to plot my escape. And even then I knew my final destination would be in London. It was a bit of a crisis because he discovered a bookshop in Cardiff where he could buy gay books, and his parents discovered his stash and his father burnt it. But they didn't say anything to him. He just discovered that these books had all disappeared. So after that he was rather in despair because he realised he couldn't talk to his parents about it at all, really, because they just didn't want to add two and two together and make four. From that day on, I became intolerable to live with. I hated my parents. I hated my life. I was locked into a religion that hated me, yet I was still bound by their ridiculous rules. One night, a few months after Dad burned my books, I remember sitting in my bedroom feeling so angry, miserable and helpless that I couldn't bear to stay in the house a moment longer. It was dark and raining, and I had no idea where I was going. I just knew I had to get out. I walked down my road to the bottom of the hill and stood on the bridge over the Rhymney River, and as I stared into the rushing water, my hands gripping the wet railings, I remember thinking, maybe it would be easier if I jumped. I was going to lose everything anyway, but once I'd been disfellowshipped by the Jehovah's Witnesses, my family and friends wouldn't be allowed to have anything to do with me. I must have stayed out there in the rain for about an hour, but in the end I forced myself to go home. That was the point I knew I had to speak to someone, because I was terrified that next time I might not have the strength to walk away. He does go and see a psychiatrist, but he can't afford more than one interview. So the psychiatrist said, talk to the Samaritans. And so he asked for a friend who was a Jehovah's Witness, but was sympathetic to the feelings he was having and thought that he was trying to deal with them. So this friend Katie drove me to a phone box. I called the number for the Samaritans, and the man who answered told me he was about to close the office for the evening, but if I could come right now, he would see me. Thankfully, the address he gave was only a short drive away. The door was answered by a middle-aged man with a kind face. By this point, I was desperate after all the effort it had taken me to get here. I needed to go home with something. I told the Samaritan the same story I had given the psychiatrist, and when I finished, he looked me in the eye and said, "I can tell you now, Luke, there's nothing wrong with you." It was the first time I had heard these words. I couldn't describe my belief. "There's a whole world of people like you out there," he went on. "I'm gay. I've got lots of friends and a wonderful life. Once you've left school, you'll be able to get a job and meet new people. But in the meantime, I promise you're not alone." I sat with that man for an hour, and when we finished, I dried my eyes, because of course I'd cried. And when I walked out of his office, I knew I was leaving with something. I was leading with hope. For me, the meeting with the Samaritan had given me the strength to keep going until I could leave home and start a new life as the person I was meant to be. I now knew there was nothing wrong with the way I was feeling. He had changed my whole perspective. The Samaritan told me to call if I needed to talk again, but I never did. That hour, a chance meeting that nearly didn't happen, had made all the difference. I knew the finishing line was in sight. "You're almost there, Luke. Just keep going." But of course, Katie does report back to the elders, and they arrived, and one of them got out a Bible. "Let's look at the scripture together." It took all my effort not to roll my eyes. "You can say what you like," I thought, "but nothing in that book is going to change who I am." The elders were kind and dealt with the matter as sensitively as they could, but now I was confident they didn't have a clue what they were talking about. I had known these men all my life. One of them was the father of my friend Debbie and ran the corner shop down the road. He might be qualified to discuss the price of baked beans, but the issue of my sexuality and how it's possible to change the very essence of who I am, not so much. "I appreciate you coming to talk to me," I said when they finally finished. "I think it's really going to help." I told them what they wanted to hear, but knew that I no longer believed a word of it. So he started living a new life, going into Cardiff quite a bit, grows up quite quickly. He leaves school and he moves to Cardiff, which of course is the capital of Wales. It's the big city if you live in Wales, although it might not be the big city for everywhere else. He meets people, and he makes gay friends for the first time. He takes singing lessons and even wins some competitions. He is taken home by a gay couple at a bar. So his first sexual experience was at 16 with two others. So, in fact, it was doubly illegal because the UK had very, very bizarre privacy laws at the time and the age of consent was still 18 at the time. He was then in relationship with a man called Tom, an older man who was also his boss. But it worked out sort of remarkably well, considering. And Tom introduced him to rich friends in London, William and Carl. But obviously his friendship with Tom was noticed because police came to his work to quiz him about underage sex. But they didn't take him very seriously when he denied it. You know, they weren't sort of following on him. But Tom was sacked. So although nobody was arrested, Tom took the brunt of it as the older man. Luke and Tom were invited to move in with William and Carl in London. And they gradually developed lives of their own, rather. William and Carl offered to send Luke to college, and they also gave Tom a job. And so he enrolled in the London Studio Centre near King's Cross. He rather lied about his living arrangements to his parents, but they obviously seemed to want to believe what they wanted to believe. But he did split up with Tom because they were living rather separate lives. He felt rather guilty about it, but he was a typical 18-year-old in many ways. But he was a bit depressed about the inevitable breakup of that first relationship. He came home to Wales for summer and he couldn't spend it anymore. So he came out to his mother, who was taken by surprise, not really knowing what to say, but did accept the fact. She tries to persuade him, "But God hates gay people," she began. "I don't want to hear it," I said. "I'm not a Jehovah's Witness anymore. There's nothing I can do about being gay. There's nothing I want to do about it. I'm perfectly happy who I am." And she accepts the fact, although she doesn't like it. But she does say, "Better not tell your father at the moment. He's in a bad place at the moment." So, but back in London, he was, of course, really living the life now. He was mixing with lots of groups. And he said that's why he never became totally attached to one particular gay group. He could mix with all of them and move around, which helped, really. His final year in college, he gets an agent and a part in a musical called La Cava. But then he got a part in a West End musical, Taboo, with Boy George. It was a musical all about the life of Boy George and starred Boy George. So being in this show meant that he was very out by now, and he decided he could do an interview. Well, I was in Taboo. I did my first interview with a gay magazine. I had been featured in a photo shoot in Gay Times to promote the show, and a writer from The Advocate, an American gay magazine, had heard it and got in touch. He was interested in me as an openly gay 21-year-old man playing a role in this very famous story of Boy George's life. So he interviewed me about living in London and working in the West End. It was a celebratory article, and I was proud of it. Perhaps if I'd known where my career would go in the future, I might have thought twice about being so open about my sexuality, because there certainly wasn't the same candidness among television and movie actors at the time. But I was a musical theatre performer. It felt like everyone in my industry was gay. Besides, nobody knew me in America. It was an American magazine. So I didn't worry about the reach of the article. The possibility it might be online hadn't even occurred to me, because the internet was so new back then that I barely used it. It was only after the magazine came out that I discovered the interview was also on their website. Suddenly I was faced with the possibility that someone from back home would see me proudly declaring I was gay. And lo and behold, Jehovah's Witness elders did see it, and they contacted him, but he just ignored it. But he and his mother decided he'd have to tell his father, as the elders already knew. And initially he had a very bad reaction and couldn't really process it. "I'm really not happy about this," he said. "Homosexuality is expressly forbidden by the Bible, and I have no idea how I'll come to terms with it. But the important thing is that you're my son and I love you. And whatever happens, we'll deal with this together as a family." We hugged each other for a long time. I felt weak with relief that Dad had come round, but now worried for my parents. I knew what was going to happen next. The religion would dictate that they should cut me off and have nothing more to do with me. It was going to be a tough time for them, but the most important thing was that they loved me. And love is far more powerful than any book or belief system. And he talked to his mother later about his father's reaction. She told me that she had held him for a while as he wept, but then pulled back and looked him in the eyes. "Dave, listen to me. You and I can go home and deal with this together, but Luke's got nobody to help him through this. He's on his own. We cannot leave him here thinking we've turned our backs on him. As much as this is against the religion, Luke needs to know that he still has us." And he was quite in awe of his mother coming through. His father, in the meanwhile, had to stop work because of poor health. And Luke, actually, who still hasn't got a lot of money, gets a loan from a friend and buys the house next door to theirs, which is for sale, so that they can own it and rent it out for an income and don't have to lose their current home. The elders did arrive. His father was no longer a leader. I think he was a sort of sub-elder or something, but they'd stopped that. But while I was visiting my parents, someone from the congregation reported them for associating with me. The elders came round to the house and were just about to start their usual lecture about the fact I was disfellowshipped and should therefore be ostracised when my dad interrupted them. "I know what you're going to say, but you can stop right now. When I got sick, who put petrol in the car? Who paid for the electricity? Who paid for the food in the fridge? Was it you? No, it was our son. Even though you've tried to keep us away from him, has Luke ever told us to leave the church? No. He's moved as far as he possibly can from us so he wouldn't bring reproach on the religion. And you're still trying to drag him back into this. Well, never again. Don't come to our house and tell us not to speak to our son, because if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't even have this house." I couldn't believe it when Mum told me this story. She said she'd never seen him be so direct and articulate. Dad had always been a stickler for rules and very conscious of setting a good example in the neighbourhood, so to hear him speak so decisively to the elders, the revered shepherds of the flock, was astonishing. If I'd needed a demonstration of the depth of his love for me, well, this was it. "This is going to stop," Dad had told them, and from that point on it did. The elders got up and left, and they never mentioned me to my parents again. After Taboo, he really struggled to get another job. He got a joint lead on a tour of Miss Saigon, which was really the highlight, but he was still living hand to mouth because of serious gaps between shows. When he was working, he was getting enough money to be okay, but of course not enough to tide him over all the gaps. So he was seriously thinking up giving it up for a more secure life. But then a top agent sees Luke and recommends that he try for a play in the Donmar Warehouse. If you haven't heard of the Donmar Warehouse, he explains, the Donmar Warehouse is a small independent theatre in Covent Garden, famed for the stellar calibre of directors, playwrights and actors who work there. Nicole Kidman had starred in a play there a few years before. It was definitely not somewhere for an all-singing, all-dancing show pony like me. But this other top agent said he would just be right for a play with young Welsh characters in it. His own agent had said it was all beyond his reach. The Donmar's beyond your reach. But he wrote directly to the Donmar people, got an audition and got the parts in a play called Small Change. And this began a total change in his life, which we will talk about in the next programme, because my timer says I only have 5 minutes left, and we wanted to hear him singing, don't we? So at the end of this first half, we're going to hear him singing Roberta Flack's The First Time I Ever Saw Your Face, which I've already mentioned him discovering as a teenager. And this was on his first album that he recorded a bit later on. So let's finish with Luke Evans singing The First Time I Ever Saw Your Face.
First time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose in your first time ever I kissed your mouth, I felt the earth move in my head. Captive bird that was there at my command, my love, and the first time I'm ever high. And I knew our joy, it would fill the earth and would last till the end of time, my love. The first time ever I saw. Your face, your face, your face.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air, for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.